This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Good morning. My name is Thomas Bowles. I'm the Managing Director for the DIA in Europe and Middle East and Africa. I'm joined here by Dr. Gregory Daniel, who is a Deputy Director and Clinical Professor at the Duke Margolis University for Health Policy. So welcome this morning. You led this morning a session on real-world evidence, a diamond session. Real-world evidence is a hot topic, I think. A lot of discussion still on the development of, okay, how do we design the guidelines for development of real-world evidence? What are the right data sources, decision-making points for regulatory decisions? Maybe to start off also for those who didn't attend the session this morning, give us a bit of a sense of what the issues were that you discussed.
First of all, thank you. It's a pleasure being here. So for the session this morning, we discussed a range of barriers, concerns, but then also opportunities for how real-world evidence can support regulatory decisions. Panelists included somebody from FDA, okay, an industry perspective. We also had somebody from NICE, so to bring in more of a global HTA perspective, and then a sort of a data company that's been doing a lot of real-world evidence. And the topics that we covered are, okay, so what value can real-world evidence bring to a regulatory decision? Why would a regulator be interested in that evidence? And then if it's so valuable, why isn't it happening all the time? What are some of the challenges with real-world evidence and steps to get there? So it was a pretty active discussion.
Okay, good. What would you say if there's one issue where it could bring the greatest value in the regulatory process?
I think it's a great question. And we go back to sort of what real-world evidence is. Real-world data are the raw materials, and they come from, as patients experience the healthcare system, data are routinely generated. Claims data, electronic health record data, and increasingly patient-generated health data from like wearable apps or wearable devices and apps. And real-world evidence is, you know, essentially bringing those raw materials, the data, together to learn from patient experiences. And oftentimes that is endpoints or outcomes that are more meaningful to patients or more meaningful to providers that may not be in clinical trials. So longer term outcomes are hard to collect in clinical trials. But you can generate evidence on populations not represented in trials. So broaden the patient population from which you learn from. Mm-hmm. And so those sort of aspects, plus real world evidence tends to be more cost effective in terms of the cost and burden of developing evidence. So the opportunity to inform labeling, oftentimes providers and patients, when they're considering a new drug or a new treatment opportunity, they look at the labeling to find out, okay, will this help the patient that's in front of me? And the challenge is, oftentimes for providers, the information in the labeling may not necessarily be relevant or closely associated with the patient that's in front of them. So real-world evidence offers the opportunity to bring into labeling more information about patient experiences and potentially more relevant information to patients and providers making those decisions.
So in this, I can say triangle, or no, it's a square almost, right? You have like the generator of the data, the company, you have the patient, you have the regulator, and the payer. Maybe we concentrate first on the payer, because we talk about the regulatory process. What do you think is the value for the payer of having more real-world evidence?
So from a payer's perspective, oftentimes when a brand new drug is on the market, you know, with traditional tightly controlled trials, the payers would say, okay, but you know, here's what my population looks like. Or once this drug is on the market, I know a lot of off-label use is going to happen outside of the parameters of the trial. And as particularly for drugs that are, you know, increasingly more costly, payers are looking at, okay, is it worth it? You know, are these products, if we pay for these products, are we going to get the outcomes and the value that we think should happen? And so what happens today is that oftentimes there aren't a lot of opportunities when a drug is on the market for a payer to really make those kinds of decisions. So they might wait a while until evidence gets accumulated, and then they say, okay, this is relevant for my population, potentially. Oftentimes payers would just cover it right away. But the opportunity for real-world evidence is to bring in that real-world experience so that payers could start to understand what might happen in their population.
From a European perspective, some of the payers I heard was saying that, well, they will feel almost more pressure to pay a certain price for a drug, because now the company provides, let's say, more robust data, and all they are interested in maybe is a price cut. Do you think this will help the discussion between industry and payers, or will it maybe even more make it more difficult?
Yeah, well, I don't think that payers would say, okay,
there's now a big challenge with more evidence. I mean, payers are always looking for more evidence, and so are patients and providers. I think the reality is for real-world evidence to support new labeled indication or something that the FDA might be looking at, clearly that data and evidence won't include costs or prices. They'd be more about clinical impact or effectiveness for a benefit as well as safety. So I don't think that necessarily will challenge the payers, although there is a trend in the U.S., and I think getting to globally is related to this, is that that real-world evidence can actually support value-based payments and movement away from fee-for-service and tying payments to actual outcomes that the patient population is experiencing. We've seen this recently with some of the gene therapy approvals, Spark Therapeutics and Novartis, where they're going out with payers and proposing pricing arrangements where they sort of track the data and evidence along the way and then tie payments so that if the product continues to be durable or continues to work and show real outcomes, then payments would be tied to that.
Maybe switching gears, because we talk about a sort of general concept, real world evidence, but of course you have different diseases, et cetera, different data sources. And what is the influence of using different data sources, different having different disease characteristics on issues like randomization and choosing of criteria?
Yeah, well, it's pretty complex. And particularly as we've been going through and looking at using real world evidence from a regulatory perspective, at the Duke Margolis Center, which is where I'm at, we've formed a real world evidence collaborative that includes FDA as well as a range of stakeholders. And, you know, at the very beginning, we kept hearing, okay, can FDA use real-world evidence? And the answer has always been, oh, it depends. Everybody says it depends. And so one of the first projects we undertook was to develop a framework, essentially, that said, okay, well, it depends on what?
Yes.
And our framework is quite simple to look at it, but it really does help guide the thinking, regulatory context and clinical context. So it depends on what's the clinical question. What evidence do we already know about that product? Is it a product that's been on the market for a long time and we really know the benefits and risks? Yeah. Or has it been on the market for a short time and maybe our safety and or effectiveness understanding is limited? Yeah. From a regulatory context perspective, FDA makes all kinds of decisions. It could be a new labeling that's related to the same indication, or it could be a brand new indication and a brand new population. It's a big spectrum of things. And so our framework starts to begin those considerations when you match up the spectrum of the regulatory context and what's already known about the product. That might give rise to different issues in terms of what real-world data sources you'd be looking at, claims linked to EHRs, registry, patient-generated health data, what's the right combination of data elements that you need, and to make sure that they're high quality. And then on the method side, you still include the element of randomization. Like within real-world evidence, you can still have a cluster randomization or a large simple or pragmatic trial versus purely observational analyses. Yep. And so depending on where you are with the regulatory and clinical context, you might begin to think about what the most appropriate design and data would be to generate fit for purpose real-world evidence.
If you wanted to do an observational study to generate relevant evidence, right, or outcomes, and again, so coming to guidelines or general, what would be sort of the, if somebody would ask you, say, what would be the criteria that you would have to think about if you set up such a study to generate this evidence?
Well, this is something that the FDA will definitely need to think about as it goes toward guidance. So FDA is on the hook to issue guidance for industry in the next couple of years that will articulate considerations around observational designs, considerations around data quality, things like that. So a lot of work needs to go into, you know, establishing the criteria. Although from my perspective and conversations that we've been having at the Duke Margolis Center, real-world evidence, when you're talking about observational designs, will take a lot of thinking about how to increase the credibility and trust in the observational design. Some of the things that we've been talking about are certainly high-quality data, being transparent about the data curation steps, the transformations from source data to your analytic data. A lot of transformations happen. And sometimes, and most often, different groups will use different data curation methods. And it'll be hard for FDA to know what was done appropriately versus not. So having more standard metrics and ways to curate the data is one thing.
Yeah.
And as far as the study design, certainly designs that can probe causality, adequately control for biases. So we've seen propensity score matching, inverse probability weighting, all kinds of new analytic approaches to control for confounding and bias. And then the third thing is more on the process side, blinding the analyst.
Yeah.
Is one step, publishing your analytic plan ahead of time and sticking to it, mm-hmm. and then also repeating the study. So it'll be challenging for just a single database study to really bring a lot, but if you can do a study in three or four different databases and show consistency in results, and the results are toward biologic plausibility, all of those things go into increasing the trust.
Okay. Okay. Maybe sort of as a final question, linking it sort of together and looking maybe a bit more to the future, because in your session, you your own input, you had the FDA, you had, as you said, from NICE or from the UK, sort of, but it's all, I think it feels like these are all concepts that are still under development, one, and second, it's sort of more, if I can put it almost like voluntarily, if I can put it like that, it's not part of the regulatory process,
right.
or as you, as we discussed a little bit, payers make ask for it, may not ask us. How do you see this? Where are we in the process? And how, if you would make a prediction, where do you see the role of real world evidence? Almost like, do we get consensus around the sort of indeed the models and the guidelines? And second, maybe, will it become sort of part of your, in the first place, your approval process? And then maybe later on, you're almost like your pricing and reimbursement process.
Every data that goes by, we generate more and more relevant data about patients and their experience in the healthcare system. Just with mobile technologies, new uses of big data, it's inevitable that we'll start to learn more from those data and that they will inform regulatory decisions and inform payment. But getting there will be a challenge because we need to make sure that we're producing high quality data, that we're getting evidence that we can trust, and that we recognize that randomized controlled trials are still the gold standard, and they're going to continue to be a large portion of the evidence that gets developed, and it's identifying how real-world evidence can supplement those activities. And so what you kind of see now, and same with the value-based payments, what you kind of see now is companies being sort of hesitant to going into that. They're saying, well, we don't have guidance yet, we're not sure what FDA is going to say about this. And then within a company, you know, they've been used to doing the traditional randomized controlled trialists. So they employ a lot of trialists who help develop the evidence. And they may be less, even within a company, you might have factions of colleagues that don't trust real world evidence or don't want to move in that direction. And then on the FDA side, same. You have a lot of reviewers who are really used to RCTs. Getting to making sure that we have high quality is going to take some time. But I think what's going to have to happen is some really well done pilot studies, an environment where a company can work with FDA to really get what a good pilot is, and making sure that that study really tests the bounds of how an observational study can be informative and when you would need to still include randomization.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, but are you aware of pilots already being conducted?
Well, I know that FDA is working with Flatiron Health to look in the oncology space.
Yep.
FDA has used real-world evidence in the past, rare diseases when they need disease registry.
Yep.
But in terms of that next big pilot and saying, okay, here's a company that wants to go after a new indication and they're proposing to use an observational or several observational studies, I don't think we're quite there yet. I know that FDA and companies are looking for those kinds of opportunities, but my guess in the next year or so, we'd really have a few good pilot opportunities potentially underway.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think
that was very interesting. And as I said, we're probably, I don't even know if we're mid-journey or the beginning, but certainly we will continue this discussion also here at the DA at our annual meetings.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.